everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Can't Save Us. As always, I'm your co-host, William Gazvy-P.
I'm Rebecca Hedman.
And I'm Paul David. And if you're listening, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Give us a 5-star rating. We really appreciate it.
Do it. Do it now. Stop listening to the podcast. Pause it. Go review. Go like. Share it. Send it to your mum. Send it to your dad. Share it around.
Just focus on one. Like maybe just maybe do Spotify this week. Maybe Apple next week. Help us out. Help us get great guests. We'd really appreciate it.
Tweet literal humans, proof that you have done it, and we will absolutely send you personalized video thank yous.
Maybe some swag.
Maybe some swag.
We have swag now.
We got cool t-shirts. We got little rabbits, like drinking coffee mugs. We got a sassy panda that cheers with a cocktail. Like, you know, you could be wearing that merch.
Drunk panda.
Drunk panda.
Who doesn't need a drunk panda as part of their swag repertoire?
Go to literalhumans.com and look at our homepage and you can see all of these animals so you know what the fuck we're talking about.
Yeah. Anyway, on to this week's topic. We're talking about how tech is revolutionizing education. And first thing we're going to talk about is the rise of online learning, a subject that I know is near and dear to many a parent's heart after the horror of the lockdowns. There's no secret that online learning has transformed education, you know, post-pandemic, and that, you know, a lot of learning institutions are trying to offer flexible and more accessible education opportunities the world over. There are any number of online learning platforms that exist now, and they offer a wide range of courses and programs. You know, in many ways, it's become a real cash cow for lots of learning institutions to be able to, you know, have more scalable programs, but also allow students to pursue education at their own pace in many cases, and to connect anywhere that they have the hardware and software and internet connection to do so. So also should say it's worth saying that it's, you know, created some or exacerbated, I should say, some inequalities in the space of education. That's what we're going to dig into today. And before we jump in, it's worth saying that education is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and spent an inordinate amount of time working in the space in the United States, about 10 years, about a little over a decade, as a teacher, was an assistant school leader at some point, ran a number of education nonprofits, and even got a doctorate in education. So yeah, it's something I care a lot about, something, a space that I've worked in. Obviously, a lot of our clients are ed tech and education nonprofits. So yeah, this is one that's close to the vest for me.
Before jumping in, I would love to know, like, when you were an educator, like, was this stuff that was on your radar? Like, because obviously, like, it seemed like the pandemic accelerated a lot of this change, but, you know, without giving away your age, slightly further back in the mid 2010s, was online learning, ed tech, like, what was the kind of cutting edge of ed tech back then?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm going to date myself here. But yeah, I remember when I first started teaching middle school in 2007. Yeah, we were definitely rolling laptop carts, like full of laptops that were charging, and they weren't good laptops. They were like, you know, really, really crap Chromebooks, if I recall correctly. Or maybe it was before Chromebooks, actually. I think it was before Chromebooks, actually, must have been. Rolling these giant carts of laptops down the hallway into our classrooms, and it definitely wasn't, at least the school that I taught in. I taught in a very poor school in Southwest Philadelphia. But yeah, it was still sort of more or less becoming more of a thing. And then sort of towards the end, when I finished, you know, we were working, building a new high school in New York City that, you know, was integrating technology throughout itself and was really competency-based education. You know, that was kind of our focus, and was really thinking about how to use tech in deeper and more interesting ways, helping kids like have their own learning portfolios, individual learning plans and stuff. So just even in like the 10-ish year career that I had, saw a lot of change, you know, and then obviously that's even accelerated in the post-pandemic world. And I really feel for teachers now and educators now, because like, they got trained on one job and then the pandemic happened and it's like a completely different job. So yeah, heart really goes out to educators out there who are trying to like balance this, you know, in-person stuff with online stuff.
Yeah, I think it's probably just worth kind of summarizing the state of play for all the listeners, which is like online learning was not really that much of a thing before the pandemic. You had some courses and some people experimenting around with it, but it really wasn't the norm. So, you know, just using universities, for example, pre-pandemic, about 4% of them were experimenting with online courses. Now it's almost a third. So it gives you just an idea of how much that has jumped, and that's sort of reflected in primary education and other sectors as well. So it really has been an absolute explosion in that 2-year period, and quite a lot of those systems have sort of continued even now that we are out of lockdown.
It's actually crazy looking at that stat, because I started university in 2016, the end of, and I was pregnant in my first year and gave birth in 2017. So I gave birth in the September of 2017 and returned back to uni in the October. So this is maybe 4 weeks after. And my lecturers gave me hell. They didn't want me to miss a lecture. They were very much, you know, you have to come in, you can't do things online. And to see how it's changed, and now they're pretty much doing the courses online, and students are flourishing. They're still getting firsts, two ones. It really is shocking, because it's like, you know, just a few years before, it was almost banned to do any kind of learning from home. So I'm actually quite glad to see that this is a stat, and maybe you guys have a different opinion, but I think it definitely allows students to be a little bit more flexible and do their studies from home, and actually encourages them to be more focused and more determined, and not be so reliant on having to come in and go to those lectures. So I'm really, really interested by those stats, actually, because that is quite a huge increase, isn't it?
Yeah, I do think that the ability to personalize at scale is always what digital gives you. And, and I do think you can just make things much more flexible, you know, for that use case, you know, your personal experience, even just like folk with learning disabilities can create an online experience that's much easier for someone with ADHD or someone who's visually impaired. So I think that's a massive tick in the pro column for online learning. Paul, what kind of stands out to you as some of the other benefits?
The potential for personalization, as you mentioned, is like a huge opportunity. But that said, and we'll get this later, like, I don't think a lot of learning institutions are doing that. Like they're basically taking what's like shitty in-person instruction and then just putting it online as a video. And so like that's a really huge problem. And that's existed pre-pandemic as well. Like that, you know, schools have already been doing that. So I think there's like a real conversation to be had with these learning institutions about like how to actually improve teaching methods and pedagogy and things like that, while also combining like a blended online learning aspect. But I think, yeah, so that's the opportunity. That's the positive bit, is like there's a huge potential to like improve, you know, curriculum and improve pedagogy to do that. I'd say another one is just like more flexibility for students. Like if you are, you know, a parent, if you have jobs, if you have caring responsibilities in your family, like that's massive. You know, it opens the door. I also like the fact that they can serve more students as well. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have been locked out of uni education, you know, one. I've seen a lot of proposals, you know, at least in the States, of like, Harvard should, you know, increase their student body by 3x because now they can. And like that, imagine what that would do for all these students, especially after the recent affirmative action decision, to have that Harvard pedigree and be able to access those classes and stuff like that. So it's like an equity thing at some point. So yeah.
We actually, on the last pod, spoke to Rocio from Latinas in Tech, and she was saying she actually works for a sort of arm of Stanford that basically is just looking to do that, where it's like it takes the Stanford Business School curriculum, pretty much makes it online and accessible, and then makes it available specifically to Latinos and other demographics that have like traditionally been underserved by that university. So yeah, there's 100% massive potential there in terms of pros.
It's an absolute no-brainer, like both from an equity standpoint. It's a bit of a cash cow as well, because all those kids are gonna be paying something at least, and they should probably offer it at a sliding scale. But and then yeah, it's just like they're also enriching the education as well. You're getting more of those voices in the classroom, and like, you know, imagine if like a deluge of underrepresented groups are going in and having conversations with the administration and the professors about how that needs to shift. Like that's all additive potentially. But yeah, it's a lot more for them to harness as well.
Also, I think that it's effective because students are actually more useful and can retain more information using online platforms. I think there's a stat here that says that students retain 25 to 60% more material when learning online, which is compared to 8 to 10% in a classroom. And I think we can all relate to being in a classroom or being in a lecture and having something go in one ear and out the other. And I think when the material is available online, it allows students to be able to go back and access it again to actually kind of learn at their own pace, which I think is very, very interesting and really useful to know, actually.
Yeah, I think that was a stat that jumped out to me as well. I think this will kind of transition into cons, is like, I think one, a lot much more research needs to be done than currently is. Like, you know, that stat was by someone who owns an online education academy, so he's always
biased.
He might be slightly biased, but I think as well there's very much a distinction these, we got to Paul's point earlier, between like what is online learning and what is not. And like just putting a 30 minute or an hour long video recording of your teacher doing the exact classroom lesson that they would have done and putting it up online, don't get me wrong, it's fine as a stopgap in the pandemic. It's not really what online learning is meant to be. You know, you do need to streamline things, turn them into interactive online courses, otherwise you'll just end up with a bunch of bored ass kids like pretending that they're going to read it and, you know, opening up YouTube on their laptop. You have to make it, like, you know, the way your LinkedIn Learning courses, the way any sort of professional learning course you pay good money for is, that's kind of the standard that you need to be hitting. And I think that that is where the biggest risk, I think, for this sector is right now, is everyone just offers something online that's super mediocre and exacerbates a lot of the problems that were happening in the classroom just at scale.
Yeah, I think we definitely need more research on the topic, and you know, it'd be interesting to kind of get someone on the pod who's looked at this, like, through the pandemic, and especially through the lens of, you know, I've read some stats out there about how folks with learning differences, you know, like, if you, everything's online and you're constantly reading and stuff like that, you worry about folks who, you know, struggle with, like, dyslexia or you know, dyscalculia, is the math one, dysgraphia, whatever, and just sort of how these online learning platforms are accounting for that, because that stuff is hard to account for in person, let alone when you're creating more distance between, potentially in some cases, between the learner. And that doesn't mean you can't. And I think that's actually a really interesting opportunity for tech entrepreneurs to kind of rise up and say, like, hey, we've solved for, you know, serving students with dyslexia through online learning platforms. That's a great, you know, app or, you know, whatever tool, idea, you know, so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, there's like positives and the negatives there in terms of the opportunity it creates. And I think also you look at, like, Khan Academy, they're doing some really interesting stuff around, like, you know, AI and, like, you know, getting kids into personalized, like, learning kind of pods, almost like a Vulcan Academy on Star Trek. I think that's really interesting. And, like, obviously there's occupational, like, job implications for real human teachers, which we can sort of get into. But yeah, I mean, you see teachers leaving the classroom in droves in many countries and things like that, partly because the role has changed. So, like, is there an opportunity to insert, which we'll get to later, like, other teaching tools like AI and things like that, to not replace teachers, but to, like, enhance the work that they're doing and help them, just like we think about it in the agency context.
I think as well, this online learning, it kind of deepens poverty, which is kind of apparent in schooling. And I think that even in in-person learning, when you go to a school, you can differentiate students based on their background. You can see the ones who, you know, will have, like, new clothes or, like, older clothes. That is just one of the examples. And I think that's why in the UK we do have things like school uniform. So I worry a little bit, because I wonder if this online learning will translate into that as well, because there are many students, in fact 1.7 million households, that don't have access to the internet, and around 10 million adults that lack the foundational digital skills that are actually required to access those kinds of essential services. So will this online learning or tech inclusion into education encourage and highlight more of this poverty disparity in the UK in particular?
Yeah, we actually had Paul Finnis from the Digital Poverty Alliance on a previous pod last season. And yeah, he spoke exactly to that, where he's like, you can't just assume that every household has, one, an internet connection, and two, a device. Like, they really don't. And quite often, especially in families from poorer backgrounds, if you set a kid homework on an online platform, they'll be doing it on their mum's smartphone or their dad's smartphone that they have borrowed, because that's the only smart device in the house, and it's like a crappy Wi-Fi connection, or it's just using the signal that they have. We haven't as a society solved the problem where every kid has a laptop and a Wi-Fi connection, or every adult has a laptop and a Wi-Fi connection for higher education. So you're kind of moving ahead of yourself to then start moving education just to be online. And yeah, it does exacerbate that kind of difference between people that do have and do not. You know, do you just end up with, yeah, this all works for the 20% of families that have a device per family member and really fast Wi-Fi? For the 80% of society that's not the case, you know, you're leaving them behind, and yeah, it just exacerbates further problems.
Yeah, I think that was one of the grimmest aspects of the pandemic that I recall, is like seeing kids, at least this was happening in the States, like kids like parked outside of a, you know, McDonald's, you know, like with maybe like a phone or a laptop that they borrowed from someone, and because they didn't have Wi-Fi access at home or broadband access at home, you know. So it's like, I think that's, to me, is like a policy failure. Like, at some point the government has to be like, look, we can't properly educate kids unless they have, you know, hot meals and a house, and like now it's Wi-Fi access. So like this sort of level of, you know, what needs to be provided, your citizenry has increased, and now it's like, well, this is just table stakes, bare minimum. I've seen schools, like, you know, there's one school we looked at out of Michigan that serves a lot of young parents and folks who are, you know, caught up in the justice system, and they just went around to each of the kids' homes and installed broadband Wi-Fi, you know, and like just solved for it that way. Like, that has to be the level of, you know, expectation of our governments. I think that, like, if you want all kids to succeed, then all kids need, you know, high speed internet access in this day and age, before we even start talking about maths until 18 or like coding classes and stuff like that. Like, that's just, yeah, I think that, and yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, government hasn't taken that stance quite yet, but I think they're starting to get the message that like they're just leaving a lot of kids behind unless they do that.
Yeah, I think as always, it's sort of like a bit of a hybrid yes and situation where, yeah, I mean, you can move towards a lot of this stuff as long as you're supplying everyone with the right tools and you're doing it well. Last thing in the world anyone wants is just, oh, we'll slap 20 YouTube videos up that are recordings from our teachers and cool, we now have an online learning sort of mechanism. That's not what this needs to be.
Wasn't it one of you that mentioned that Mexico has free public Wi-Fi?
The city of Mexico City has public Wi-Fi that's like actually not that bad in terms of performance all over the city. And yeah, I mean, I haven't read anything about how families and kids specifically are engaging with that or what the implications are for schools. But I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer to have that.
I wonder if London could get something like that and how that would work over here. I mean, not just London specifically, but in the UK in general, and how we would be able to work towards that. As you said, it is the government's kind of doing. I don't think we're close to having that happen.
Organisations like Digital Poverty Alliance, yeah, they're filling in that gap that the government isn't, where they're trying to provide the Wi-Fi and the sort of hardware that families need to access a lot of this stuff. It's education that was focused on the latest, but, you know, it's just the most current element of a trend of like there are a lot of families that are getting left behind by the digital revolution that happened 20 years ago, let alone the education revolution that's happened the last 2 years. So yeah, a lot more that needs to be done by the government, by us, by a society, before we can kind of get onto the real benefits that and opportunities that we just spoke about. So we've covered kind of some of the pros and cons of online education. I'm now going to move us on to our second topic, which is the use of AI in teaching. There's been some interesting developments in this space, you know, some folks showing that you can use AI to tailor content and teaching methods to individual student needs and their learning types. You could also potentially use AI to automate a lot of the administrative tasks that educators find incredibly, you know, trying and draining. You know, a large part of a teacher's time is spent marking homework. Could all maths and science homework, where there's just a straight right answer, be automated with AI? That would free up tens of hours a week for educators' time. I guess, and Paul, I'd love to get your, as a former educator, like your view on this. Like, what do you see as like AI, and can it be used in a way that doesn't replace teachers but helps them, and especially in both the US and the UK, reverses the massive trend we've been seeing recently of just educators leaving the profession in droves?
Yeah, if I'm really, really honest, I think we're gonna have to think a lot more expansively on just like what teachers' roles are gonna be and how many of them are going to be, and yeah, so like we may have to let go of this idea that like everyone's going to keep their jobs in exactly the same way. Like, let's just be absolutely real about it. That said, I think the biggest opportunity that I see is for learning to take place at the pace of the student rather than the teacher. And I think a lot of ways, like learning, you know, what you learn, how you learn it to some extent is like limited by how much sleep did your teacher get last night, and like how, you know, like how well trained have they been, and like what is their, you know, level of knowledge in the particular curricular area. So like I think there's huge opportunities there for it learning to become truly self-paced from the positionality of the student, and like empower students a lot more. I think students are wildly disempowered by the learning institutions and structures that we have. I think I at least reached a point in my career as an educator where I got pretty disenchanted with like how much schools just sort of socially reproduce the conditions that students are in rather than actually empowering them to like change the world and like think, you know, more like it just got to a point where it felt like we're training them to be like little economic actors in the current system and not really fundamentally shake things up. And I think you see that even by like having curriculum, you know, structured the way that we do. Like, you're a, you know, chemist, you're a nurse, like you're a, like you have to fit this thing rather than like really pushing things. And I think maybe that's somewhat of a unique feature about learning in the States sometimes, where like kids can kind of, you know, think more broadly and just like experiment with a lot of different things, where in other nations, I understand, it's a bit more centralized in a way. But yeah, that's what made like competency-based learning really exciting, I think, for some of the work I was doing at the end. It was like, you know, you could put kids on these individual learning pathways and they could come to you as a teacher and be like, hey, I was working on this thing on my laptop, and like, do you as the teacher think that I've, you know, mastered this like competency or this sub-competency or this task or whatever? That was super cool. And that was like cutting edge, you know, when I was doing that work in like 2015. I think it's probably advanced now, but yeah.
Again, the potential's there, although I, on the flip side of that, like what I do worry about with AI in education is you know, the biggest issues we've seen with AI already is that they confirm the bias of the people that create the large language models. And I do worry, you know, to our previous point, do you just end up confirming the bias of curriculum at scale? Like, you know, like if, and I know it's not exactly a hot take to be like, yeah, you could do it if you did it properly. But I do think, like, probably more than anything with AI in education, I'm really, really worried and don't have a huge amount of faith that, like, the government-led education curriculum will use AI in a way that actually empowers teachers, empowers learners. You just worry it becomes, here is a very smart chatbot tied up to our curriculum, teaching kids on their own for a fraction of the cost of employing humans to do it. So yeah, that's probably my big fear about this space. And, you know, I just don't think my government or your government has a great track record of this kind of thing. Because, you know, education's already a mess before you add AI. How is AI going to stop it being a mess rather than just kind of feed off that mess and systematize it into a large language learning model?
And I think as well, going off what you're saying, Will, it's really important to recognize that we can't just throw these teachers into the situation where it's like, here's this AI, use it. And, you know, only 17% of teachers had actually used AI tools to help with schoolwork, and more than half felt that, 56% to be exact, shared that they felt that education professionals, so teachers and any kind of teaching assistants, needed proper training. So I think before you even get to the place where AI is automating teaching or taking over teachers' positions, you need to get these teachers in a position where they actually understand AI and understand how to utilize the technology that's at hand, not to just help them mark work or create lessons plans, but to tailor their students' learning journeys. Like you were saying, Paul, you were able to assess and individually create plans for your students. And I think that there needs to be some kind of training inserted into maybe like teacher qualification if we are going to move forward and use AI in day-to-day teaching practices. So I think that that would be a great first step before we even think about automating any kind of teacher.
I think the opportunity is huge. Like if AI can enhance lessons and sort of say, okay, here's this general piece of content that we want, you know, to be taught to students. And then you, like, you input data about the students into the AI model, and it gives the teacher like 30 tailored lesson plans for all 30 students, and how, like, okay, I need to, like, really think about, like, Jamal's, you know, particular learning style and how I'm going to teach this piece of, like, that would be massive, right? And then also just like the administrative workload, taking that off their plates, like scoring most, if not all, of, you know, assessments or something like that. And then the teacher can kind of look it over just like we would, you know, looking at the output from, you know, a chat bot and say, like, okay, this is 80, 90% correct in terms of how they've assessed the student. So, like, but I think that opens up for the opportunity for that personalization at scale, which is really exciting. I mean, I know a lot of teachers would, but I think that also does, yeah, to your point, Rebecca, like, require a large scale shift in how we think about training and support, and also just like how many, the number of teachers that we have. Like, you're gonna, if that's the case, if that happens, you'll probably need fewer teachers.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so, but like, what do we do with those folks? We need to retrain them. We need to, you know, they, like, and that this is across like all sectors. We're seeing this and stuff like that. So, like, the good news is that the nature and hopefully quality of the teaching job changes, moves a little bit more upstream, and becomes more about how you leverage these tools to actually personalize at scale. And then, you know, but it's also going to mean probably a net loss in jobs. But then again, that's a policy issue. Like, the government needs to be like, all right, what are we going to do to retrain these massive numbers of teachers, you know, and help them find work or universal basic income? I don't know. But like, it's just going to happen. So,
and for an industry like this where there's already a massive shortage of teachers, actually finding a way to make it more efficient so that you need fewer teachers to, you know, teach at scale is a very good thing. Because,
yeah,
you
know, solves
the issue. Yeah, just, as you said, the fear I have is you use AI and make it worse, and then you lose even more teachers, and then, oh my God. But in the immediate short term, I think as well, there's kind of like the building of tools that like to do some of the tasks that we just spoke about, which you know, 100% should be, it definitely is already being invested in. You know, we know from our work in the edtech space, like, there are folk working on that. The problem is, you know, then making them accessible and then democratic. I think one of the other things that like every school needs to do right now is like figure out and agree on a policy for its kids that might be using AI platforms that already exist. You know, like ChatGPT, guarantee you your students are using it. So what is the line between plagiarism and using it as a tool? You know, like, obviously, if you ask it to write you an essay on Shakespeare, yeah, that's plagiarism. If you've written an essay on Shakespeare, you put that essay into ChatGPT and ask it for the counter argument to your essay, is that plagiarism? Is that enhancing your essay with a considering the counterpoints to then address them in your essay? You know, that's where the line becomes a little finer. If you train a chatbot persona to write like Keats and then get it to brainstorm poetry ideas in their style, again, I know it's very difficult to define that line between tool and plagiarism, and I do think that's something universities and schools need to sort out ASAP in the immediate term, because, you know, every kid is using ChatGPT and Bard the way they started using Google when it first came out. So you need those immediate short-term policies, and actually probably does need to come from the government and get pushed out across the entire education sector so everyone has a sort of common standard. But yeah, that's something in the short term that I think needs to happen, like, you know, like this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think in education there's a particular taxonomy called Bloom's taxonomy, right? And that's basically like it's worth a look. It's Benjamin Bloom, made it up, and I think it's become like a web or something like that. But what you're talking about there is like one of the skills of learning is synthesis, right? And you want to like kind of walk kids through, right? So there's like knowledge, you know, there's comprehension, there's application, there's analysis, then there's synthesis, then there's evaluation. Those are like roughly the six levels of Bloom's taxonomy. And so just like when the World Wide Web came out, we changed our definition of what synthesis means. It used to be, okay, go to the library, get a bunch of hardback books out, read them, take your little notes, and then write your essay. Then with the World Wide Web and Google and things like that, it's now like, okay, you have all this information at your fingertips, way more than you had before, and it's more curated than it was before. And you see this in content marketing even, like people are taking snippets of information that is secondary source and integrating it, you know, and hopefully not copying it verbatim, right? But if we're honest with ourselves, there was a lot more space created for people to take snippets from like the Google, you know, snippet you see at the top there and integrate it into what we then deemed to be acceptable synthesis, right? Now that's shifting even more. And ChatGPT is like just writing a lot of stuff for us, you know, like it's basically taking that information that came from a search engine and, you know, distilling it for us. And so like, if we're really honest with ourselves, I think our understanding of what synthesis as a learned skill is going to mean and how much of it we're going to accept in the educational context. And the line will then shift of like, okay, well, what do we do with people? How do we grade people? You know, I think that's a whole other, grading is going to be a whole other interesting conversation. And then how do we include this new form of synthesis into what we think of as like acceptable learning process and things like that? I think that's going to be fascinating. And sure, someone's writing a PhD thesis about this right now somewhere, but yeah.
It is super interesting, because I think then you kind of move into a deeper question where you think, do we apply this to every industry? Where do we draw the line? Because I know that recently there was an art competition and the winner of the art competition created their artwork using AI and, you know, admitted that in the end, you know, I did use AI. And I think it's hard to draw the line and say what is cheating or what is manipulating tech, because at the end of the day, we all know, we all use ChatGPT, and you don't just, it doesn't just generate an essay. You don't just write, you know, create me an essay and then it gives you the best essay in the world. It gives you what you put in. We just had this workshop with Dale and Byron Spark on Thursday, which was amazing and kind of gave us a little bit of a deeper insight into the prompts that we put into ChatGPT. And I think if a student is able to produce something extremely well written, or even a snippet, as you mentioned, Paul, for something from AI or tech, then they have to be incredibly skilled and careful with what they put into that chatbot to actually generate an output. So I think it's really, really a thin line as well. And I think we have to be, another point on that is that teachers as well. I read about a teacher in Texas who failed his whole class and basically said, you've all used ChatGPT, and was actually wrong. So, you know, it works both ways. How are we regulating that? How are teachers able to detect what's been used in ChatGPT? I think Turnitin at the moment, I think that's what I was using at uni as well. Turnitin detects plagiarism. But are they able to detect ChatGPT? Will students be able to fool that level of tech? It's ever moving. So I think there are a lot of different questions around plagiarism.
Yeah, I think this example that we saw reading from the Forbes piece here, but like this example of this individual using ChatGPT to pass the United States medical licensing exam, which is essentially the exam you have to take to see if you can become a doctor. I think that's really interesting, because like that tells us that that exam is probably more geared towards some of the lower levels of Bloom's taxonomy, which is just sort of like, can you recall knowledge, right? And I think this is like a core problem in teaching and learning, is that like so many of the things that we have out there are basically just like, are you good at English? Can you recall facts? You know what I mean? Can you generally write well? And that's like pretty much the bar. And that's like, when you look at Bloom's taxonomy, it's kind of a low bar. It's like knowledge and comprehension. It doesn't get us to the level of like synthesis and evaluation, like the higher bits of learning. So we're talking about like a fundamental shift of like, well, maybe the test isn't right. If you can use a tool like that, that is mostly about like collecting information and recalling it and spitting it back out, then that tells me that that exam needs to move. And like, I don't know all the details of how the U.S. medical licensing exam is created and all that stuff. You know, and I haven't dug into the sort of curriculum or pedagogy around it, but it does raise interesting problems of like, maybe our tests need to change. You know what I mean? Like, and now that we have powerful tools like ChatGPT and generative AI, like maybe it's high time that they do. And maybe like just the existence of the tools and the things they can do tell us that like we need to move more upstream with our, you know, teaching and learning practice.
Mm. If anything, that does speak to the potential of it, which is like, okay, well, if we teach everyone, you know, of our students how to use generative AI and ChatGPT properly, they can pretty much have a lawyer's, like access to a lawyer, access to if you can pass the medical licensing exam, do you get to a point where, you know, there's much less demand for doctors because most of your populace can diagnose itself either with ChatGPT or a specialist software you've built off the back of ChatGPT, which you just input your symptoms and get back like a 99.9% accurate assessment of what, you know, what you might have. Those sort of professions across the board that are quite walled garden, does actually giving everyone access to that knowledge in a way that's easy to use make society better? Like, you know, it's a big fucking if, but like quite possibly. It's kind of a wild and interesting time.
Okay, and for the last topic, we are going to take a look at the government's efforts to try and integrate technology into the education system. There has been some progress, but of course there's always room for improvement. So let's take a look at the steps that the government is taking to promote digital literacy and provide any access to technology in schools. And in the natural course of Tech Can't Save Us, I'm going to bring back to the government and do the they maybe not want to incorporate tech, because as you said, it might raise the question of, is the curriculum correct, and how much work will that take to overhaul the curriculum that's in place right now? And I think AI and tech will show the cracks in education, not just for the poverty disparity, but for the actual curriculum itself, in terms of what students are asked to do for their essay questions, to pass these exams. I mean, that is a pretty huge exam. So for ChatGPT, for a student to pass using ChatGPT, you do have to wonder, as you said, what are these questions? What are they being assessed on? And I think that that is a deeper question that maybe the education secretary, Gillian, is not wanting to kind of delve into. And I think it's important because, I can only speak for the UK. I think this is probably one of the reasons why the UK as a whole is always behind. We're not up to date. Europe's using technology in their schools at a far greater rate than we are at the moment. And I think that that allows them to kind of assess those questions and look at those situations and actually be able to improve. So I think there are some deeper questions for the government there that they probably are not wanting to come out of the woodworks, but it's all very interesting and I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Yeah, they definitely don't. And I'm going to go off on one here. This is my hobby horse.
Do it.
I think it's going to be bigger than just like showing the cracks. Like I would love students to really get their hands on tools like generative AI and just like put their hands deep in the cracks and rip open the cracks and to really show. And I think like you're already seeing this from students who are like protesting at universities about like the way education has changed and things like that. I think if we're really honest with ourselves about what education tends to be for a lot of, like, it's like a daily babysitting service for, you know, like families. And unfortunately, a lot of government officials like don't actually want to create this like expansive learning environment where kids question the nature of what their government's doing. And like, you know, they don't want that because that's going to cause problems for them down the line. You know, like those folks are going to be incredibly informed voters who are going to shift the balance of power, and they're going to get out in the streets and do a lot more and be less of what we've sort of been conditioned to be, which is like great little consumers who like, you know,
pay tax.
Yeah, we pay tax. We watch Netflix. We don't actually like fundamentally get out there and question things. And I think like, you know, this has the potential to kind of open that up, because I think what's interesting about generative AI is like if it forces people to change the questions they are asking of the tool, of the prompt, right? But like it really puts the, like, you have to put in the right prompt to get out, right? And I think that's a really, like, dangerous and potentially transformative shift in education, where, like, kids are really going to start to think about, like, I have this new powerful tool. What do I put into it, you know? And then what does that cause me to get out of it? And I think, yeah, I mean, I'm actually super keen for this to, like, upend education, because I think if we're really honest with ourselves, like, we have an agrarian education system in this, like, sort of, you know, hypercharged knowledge and information economy right now. And it serves a particular purpose. You know, it allows parents to go to work during the day and do what they need to do while their kids are in school and being looked after and stuff like that. But it is not keeping pace with technological and I would argue even, like, human development change, you know, like the knowledge that kids can process today compared to when these systems were set up, I think is exceeded the structure of the system itself, you know, and I think that's a big lift for government to take on.
I think that's really interesting as well in terms of, like, one of the things AI is very, like, action-based. Like, it's like it's giving you a shortcut to the knowledge that you would otherwise have to spend 3 or 4 hours researching on the internet, or in the previous sort of technological revolution, just reading up on and learning and sort of imbibing personally. And quite often what that then gets you to do is, like, at a place where you can take some form of action much quicker than you otherwise would have. And so, yeah, like, what that then potentially does to society is very interesting. You know, like, if I, as a 18-year-old entrepreneur, don't need to learn tax law so that I can run a business, I can just use a generative model to give me the answers I need to the 3 or 4 specific questions I need to start my business. Does that free up, you know, me to fucking create something awesome? Like, you know, does it democratize knowledge in a way that ultimately makes the world a better place is such an interesting question. The scary side of this is, I think, actually, whether we fucking like it or not, this is happening and it's going to happen. So it's like, we're going to find out in 5 years whether it makes the world a better or worse place. Because, yeah, kids are using this. We're using it. Like, everyone is using this in a business and education setting. And I think, as is normally the case, as we saw with social media, with Google, we'll just find out in 10 years' time what the impact on society is.
The children will lead us. They yeah. will, as they always do, they will lead us. They will show us, like, kind of, it's unfortunate, like, that was so much of the work that we did when I worked in New York City Department of Education, which is you know, in the U.S., the nation's largest school system, like 1.1 million kids, I think it's more than that now, was, like, we actually went out and we, you know, interviewed students who were in their ninth grade, which is the first grade of high school, and asked them, what would you want your high school experience to be? And the shit we got back was just, like, groundbreaking, you know, in terms of just, like, you know, how do you integrate tech? Like, what's the role of the teacher, making the teacher less of a sage on a stage and more of, like, kind of a, you know, conductor of learning among the students? What teachers can learn from students and stuff like that. And we had some, you know, pretty radical proposals about how to do that stuff that ultimately didn't quite get input because, like, the system is the system, right? And, like, look at the reactions that we're seeing to generative AI, like, you know, 400 uni students being investigated for using AI bots like ChatGPT to quote unquote cheat on their assessments and stuff like that. One of my favorite quotes of all time is Oscar Wilde, everything is about sex except sex. Sex is about power, right? Which, like, if you follow the logic, everything is about power, right? And so, like, think about, you know, the reaction to this new powerful tool that's in the hands of students being control and power from officials who, you know, like 34% of educators polled think that ChatGPT, one of the most powerful learning tools that's probably ever existed to date, should be banned. They want to ban, like, the most powerful learning tool that students have there. That's fascinating, number one. And then meanwhile, 66% of students support having access to it, right? So, like, that data point alone tells you, you know, a lot of what you need to know about where we are in this particular moment, that, like, students recognize the value of it. They see what it can help them do. They're preparing to use it for their education. They are using it for their education and preparing to use it for their eventual careers. And the adults in the room are like, no, 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 no. And it's just like, what are we really doing here? You know, it's just so, like, I think watching that dynamic is going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
I think, too, particularly in the UK, there is a real sort of, as always, a diametrically opposed forces where, you know, Gillian Keegan, the education secretary, bet you didn't fucking know that, called Gillian Keegan. They're calling on educators and tech experts to provide ideas on how AI can be used in a positive way to support the education sector. About 5 years ago, the Conservative Party completely tore up the education system in the UK and, like, purposefully made it as old school as possible and harking back to what conservatives think good education is, which is like, oh, we sang Great Rule Britannia and, you know, learned facts about how actually colonization was great. Like, it, you know, like they took that step, educators left in fucking droves. Michael Gove's in charge of it. Everyone hates him because he's an absolute waste of skin. And, you know, it set us down a path where, we, you know, that's where education is now. And Gillian Keegan comes out and says, you know, I want to do X, Y, and Z. And it's like, all right, cool, man. Well, like, this is the scale of the challenge facing you now if you actually want to make good on any of those promises.
I think we consistently underestimate how political education is. And like, think about that from the Conservative Party perspective. Like, we really want to just like put our boot down on, you know, these potential students who are going to question authority, because we are a very hierarchical party and we believe in falling in line. And
it's such a transparent attempt to raise more conservative voters. Like, you know, like they literally spoke about putting more patriotism into the education curriculum. It's such a, how do we make kids who fucking hate the Conservative Party less likely to think, like, or like more brainwashed to think, actually, you know what, Thatcher and capitalism are great.
The beauty of it is that like things like that tend to have the opposite effects, luckily, and God bless our kids for, you know, being that way and just like, you know, adequately reacting to the ridiculous that the adults are foisting upon them, hopefully.
That was in the UK, and to flag in the US as well, education has become such a politicized landscape. You know, you have fucking critical race theory and all this other mental shit that people are now harping on about, and, you know, to enter that fray and try and convince folk that they need to use AI and sort of all of these generative tools and all of this online education stuff we just spoke about, like, you know, that, as much as I do think both the Trump administration and our current administration were not up to the task and kind of incompetent, even for someone who I think is genuinely trying, like Biden, and fucking fingers crossed Keir Starmer gets elected in the next UK election, it's such a mammoth task to be trying to address these issues that are like, you know, not just changing education, but changing society, and then trying to build a curriculum around it. I don't hold out a huge amount of hope it will be guided by a sort of benevolent helping hand. I think it will just be the sort of thing that happens on its own, and then we figure it out after the fact.
And to be fair, like to Rebecca's earlier point about like the cracks in the system, I think like these cracks were there before. I think like generative AI has just like shown a stronger light on things that were existing. But I would argue the university model as it even exists is like incredibly outdated. And at least in the States, it's like only, I think, 25% of people in the States actually go to uni and graduate. So like there's a huge percentage that go and never make it out. And then obviously, like, you're telling me that you have this whole, like, your whole society is pointed towards this thing that like everyone quote unquote should do, but only a fourth of them actually get through it successfully. Like, that is a abysmal failure. Like, you know, is it like just the fact that stat alone is like, wow, like we really, and that's why what, you know, Stanford and some of these other universities are thinking about doing, Southern New Hampshire University is another one, where they're just like creating these massive online, now again, a lot of them aren't great pedagogy and curriculum, but at least access is being open. So I think like, yeah, these systems were broken before. Some schools are responding in kind by creating, you know, new learning opportunities and pathways, which is great. They need to get better. But like, I think, yeah, these cracks were there before. And it's just, yeah, shown, you know, exactly how they exist in a starker relief, I think.
And I think as well, when you talk about the cracks being shown, it's going to create more exposure to some of the issues that are in schools that are not necessarily related to education. So I know earlier on, well, you spoke about children with disabilities or any kind of learning impairments. And I think that when you kind of look at online learning and what it actually can push, it's kind of this way to avoid teachers having access to children in the physical. When you think about actually how many issues are raised from teachers actually seeing children in the classroom in their physical appearance or their mental appearance or how they come across, that is something that scares me a little bit about online learning or the automation of tech, because we lose that, not to be too kind of hippie-ish about it, but that sense of community. And I think that teachers are, you know, you said earlier, Paul, like a daycare or a babysitting kind of care, and in a way, yeah, they definitely are, but they also are that level of protection for children. I think if there is something wrong at home when children come into schools, often it is the teacher that flags that. So we have to wonder what will come or what will become of our children if we kind of remove that level of teacher interaction, and even just the way that they interact in society, you know, how you make friends. Think of all the friends that you have from your primary school days, or your, I'm still friends with all my friends from primary school, secondary school and college. So it really does worry me a little bit about the interactions there. So yeah, I'm interested to see what happens in that regard as well.
I mean, I agree with you. As someone who's like been in those classrooms and like made those connections with students where like, you know, like I could pull Dimitrik aside and talk to him about the fact that he lost his dad because, you know, I had lost a parent as well, you know, and like that, you can't, like AI can't do that. And I think there's that level that, you know, dare I say, you know, we can never replace people, but like that, you need to maintain that, you know, that needs to stay, like that human connection needs to stay. And like, I think about the teachers that I've had that affected my path. Shout out to Mr. Doyle, Miss Montique, you know, all these teachers, but like the fact that they were incredible teachers and had an indelible mark on my life doesn't also negate the fact, and it kind of works both ways, that like a lot of the rest of the other education I received could have been better. Tech tools could have enhanced it, or, you know, just different structuring of the system could have enhanced it and things like that. So like we need to have a both and understanding of like, how do we maintain the human connection that like needs to happen for students to develop socially with teachers and other folks, but also how do we enhance it using tech, you know, and scale it, you know, like increase access, increase quality at the same time. I think that has to be the government's approach. Like both have to happen, you know, at the same time. In fact, one becomes more important, right? That human touch becomes more important in some ways because we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves with these tech tools and having things just march forward in that way.
Yeah, I do wonder if like ultimately what the sort of longish, maybe 20 years result of all this will be is like actually a teacher is purely there for that human connect. Like, you know, they're there to lead you through the learning that you're going to take mainly through digital tools and, you know, be there as a support for that. But is far more there to facilitate one-on-one conversations about what you're up to and how you're doing as a person, and then also facilitate sort of group social interactions with other kids so you learn those soft skills and, you know, as well just enjoy that part of education, which, you know, for many people is the only bit they enjoy. Like, you know, is the school system shit, the fact they get to hang out with their mates and you know, that's the draw. So yeah, I wonder if that could be the end goal, where like teachers are far more counselors and pastors of their pupils rather than like educators and, like you said, a sage on a stage.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity to like deepen the professionalization of the, you know, teaching profession. If we're really honest and we look at like the superstructure of like how teaching has been, you know, created, like I think there's a massive sort of patriarchal element to it, where we've like kind of put teaching in this and we've like relegated to being like a mostly, you know, women-led workforce. And then we've like systematically underpaid them and undertrained them. And you look at, you know, teachers are striking here in the UK. There's like major issues and stuff like that. And like, that's fucked up. Why'd we do that? And then we're like worried about, you know, like the quality of it. It's like, well, you haven't paid these people well. You have not trained them well, you know what I mean? And you've put it on the backs of women who also have caring responsibilities for their own kids and stuff like that. Like I had a friend who was a middle school teacher who also had her own kid and was like trying to juggle online learning during the pandemic with her own child, who was like in a different learning pod, and she ended up like bringing her into her learning pod and stuff like that. So like, I think there's like some larger cultural issues we need to solve for as we're like beefing up the profession and, you know, improving it. Is like, yeah, we've done some not great things to teaching as a profession that need to change, you know, how we resort and things like that. And once we do that, we can sort of integrate those tech tools, hopefully. But AI doesn't solve that. Training does a little bit, but like there's just like, we live in a society that pays bankers more than teachers. Like that feels a little bit backwards, I think, to a lot of people. And so how do we fix stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that's a good note to end on, actually, is like, I actually think AI and tech is a very good catalyst to reimagine education. That's the lens it should be viewed in, is like, yeah, these tech tools allow us to do a lot of things, but fundamentally we have a education system that's been the same since the Victorian era. How do we modernize with all of this tech in mind? But you know, it can't just be slapping AI into an existing structure. It needs to be, what does AI mean for the entire structure, and how do we fix some of these fundamental problems?
Well, from automated lesson plans, digital literacy for core curriculum, and of course, Gillian Keegan as the champion for AI in classrooms, it's definitely been a rollercoaster of an episode. Thank you for listening to another episode of Tech Can't Save Us. We'd appreciate your likes, shares, and subscriptions, of course. Do take care, and thank you very much.
And if you got input, we're open to hearing it. Our inbox is open, our ears are open, our eyes are open. Shoot us a note at hello@littlehumans.com. Once again, that goes directly to me. We should fix that with thoughts and feedback on today's episode. Don't forget to give us a subscribe, a like, a 5-star rating, and we will catch you next time on Tech Can't Save Us.